From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The EPA doesn't often pull registered pesticide products from the market, but this month it did. The agency pulled a dozen products containing a compound thought to be harmful to bees. The chemicals are called neonicotinoids, and there are already some restrictions on them in Europe and Canada. So what impact will the product ban have on farmers here in the U.S., and will it do enough to help pollinators? This hour On Point, bee-harming pesticides and the future of food and farming. And you can join us. Do you welcome the ban on some neonic pesticides, or could that hurt your crops? What's your question about how to best protect pollinators and the farmers who grow our food? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we'll hear about why some national labor unions are pushing back against the so-called Green New Deal. But first, let's start with this news about pollinators. And joining us from Washington is Adam Allington, chemicals and pesticides reporter for Bloomberg Environment. He's also host of Bloomberg Environment's Business of Bees podcast. Adam, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about how the EPA ended up deciding to pull these 12 products. It wasn't a result of a regular, like, regulatory examination, was it?
That's correct. This is actually the result of a previous settlement agreement between three major pesticide companies, Bayer, Syngenta, and Valent, who agreed to voluntarily pull these 12 neonic products as a result of a settlement where they will voluntarily remove them from the market. However, there are still quite a few of your frontline pesticides that are still available that do contain these neonic active ingredients.
Okay. So let's explore that more in a second about these other products. But we should first just get a sense as to what are these so-called neonics, which we'll call them for short, neonics? How long have they been on the market, and what do we know about their toxicity to pollinators?
Right. So neonics have been on the market since the 1990s. They were originally developed as a replacement for the organophosphate class of pesticides. Organophosphates are actually toxic to mammals and to humans in certain concentrations. And neonics are less toxic to mammals, but also very potent to insects. They're a neurotoxic pesticide, meaning they attack the central nervous system of insects. And they're also, compared to these other pesticides, which are sprayed and applied to the plants themselves, neonics are often used as a seed coating directly on the seed. So mm-hmm. the seed is planted, it grows, and then becomes the plant itself becomes toxic to insects. So it's a systemic pesticide, meaning a bee or a fly or any insect comes along, lands on the plant, and then it's, you know, potentially could die.
Okay. Well, I definitely want to dig in more into what we know specifically about how the nature of the harm that these pesticides present, I should say, to bees. But Adam, let me ask you, though, specifically about this settlement, as you're saying, that led to the pulling of these 12 products by the EPA. I'm seeing here that Bayer's noting that two of them aren't even sold in the United States. Is that right?
That's correct. That gives you a sense of why perhaps the pesticide makers didn't fight this or didn't sort of protest this settlement as much as they might have. These pesticides are still on the market for their main customers. That is, you know, farmers, big agricultural operations. These are just, you know, the nature of the lawsuit was that neonics ran afoul of the Endangered Species Act, that the EPA didn't consider the effect that these pesticides would have on endangered species when they were registered. Therefore, this, you know, call it an interim step, so to speak. Mm-hmm. These 12 products are going to go off the market now. But what the pesticide makers really are lining up to, you know, for the real battle, which will, you know, come in the coming years when these products have to be re-registered under EPA and the environmental groups will make the same claim that this entire class of chemicals is, you know, runs afoul of the Endangered Species Act.
Well, doesn't the legal settlement compel the EPA to analyze the impacts of this class, as you said, of pesticides on endangered species, compels the EPA to do so? Is that the battle, the coming battle you're talking about?
That's correct. You know, EPA will have to, when they re-register each of these active ingredients, they're going to have to do a specific study that says, you know, whether or not use of this pesticide would pose a significant threat to endangered species. And that, you know, that's not just your eagles, you know, your large mammals and so forth. This is also, you know, everything from small insects to bees and pollinators, like the rusty-patched bumblebee, for instance, was listed on the Endangered Species Act in 2017. So this could pose a significant hurdle for EPA and for the pesticide makers if they're going to make the claim that these pesticides are safe for use, which they is their position now. But, you know, it's you know, the this also coincides with significant die-offs among bees and pollinators and insects. That is, you know, an increasingly solid body of science behind that. And the environmental groups point to neonics and say that these die-offs coincide directly with the use of neonics.
Well, we did reach out to several of the chemical companies that were involved in this settlement. Again, this is a legal settlement. It's not a choice made by the EPA. It's a legal settlement. Bayer sent us back a statement from Christine Kring, the vice president and associate general counsel of Bayer U.S. Crop Protection. And in that statement, Kring says that Kring notes that it was technicalities over the EPA's approval process that led to this settlement. And she says that, in fact, the court found that there was no evidence that these products present a, quote, imminent hazard to endangered species, which had been the original focus of the lawsuit. So, Adam Allington, stand by here for just a moment, because I want to get a response to that claim from Amy Code. She joins us from Eugene, Oregon. She's the pesticide program director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And while not involved in the case that led to this EPA decision recently, Xerces has joined complaints against the EPA regarding the regulation of pesticides in other cases. So, MA Code, welcome to you.
Hello. Thanks. Well, I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, I just want to hear your response to what Bayer sent us in this press release or the statement saying that the court found that there was no evidence that these neonics or these products present a, quote, imminent hazard to endangered species. What is the state of the science on that?
Well, I think Adam began to discuss that, but we have a growing body of science that is showing significant concern with these chemicals for pollinators and a number of other invertebrate species. But if we take a step back, the whole point is that with this settlement, the decision is that the wildlife agencies and EPA need to begin to evaluate the risks to endangered species. That's exactly what needs to happen. We need to take a deep look at these risks and understand what steps need to be taken by the federal government to ensure the safety of these species that are on the brink of extinction.
Okay. I do genuinely want to understand more about sort of the complex science and biology around how pollinators are you know, interacting with these pesticides, and why environmental groups or point to neonics as being a threat to pollinators. Because there have been a series of studies that have come out that have shown what? That in some cases, crops that use neonics perhaps weren't devastating to pollinators if those crops are surrounded by a variety of other wildflowers. I mean, explain to us what's going on here.
So obviously, the environment and what we're dealing with is extremely complex, and there are multiple stressors that pollinators are facing. So you are right, they are lacking nutrition at times, and if they have good nutrition, they are better able to fight off other stressors that they're dealing with, which might be pesticides. You can also look at, you know, some studies that do a very narrow look at a single application on a small field, and then you step back and do a landscape study and look what's happening because of these seed treatments that Adam was talking about over the hundreds, you know, hundreds of millions of acres where they're being applied. And so there's many ways to look at the science and evaluate risk. I think some of the things, well, you Adam talked a little bit about these being systemic. When we look at neonicotinoids, they are part of the issue. I would say we need to look at pesticides broadly. We need to look at nutrition. But neonics have multiple strikes against them. They're highly toxic to our invertebrates. They have a direct route of exposure to pollinators because they're systemic and they can be found in the pollen and nectar of plants. And they're extremely persistent. That means they're going to be lasting for a really long time in the environment. So bees can be exposed quite a long time even after that application occurred. So they have multiple strikes, which is why people hone in on them as a key concern. Not the only concern, but key.
So Adam, I mean, you are host of Bloomberg Environment's Business of Bees podcast. Tell us a little bit more about what the science tells is demonstrating to us right now about the complexity of these environments and how these neonic pesticides play into that complexity.
Well, you know, what some of the pesticide makers have told me in the past is that these neonic pesticides are actually more targeted. And so targeting is important if you're applying pesticides because you want to limit the exposure directly to the, you know, to the field where you're putting it. And so since these are coated on the seed and just impact, you know, the plants themselves, they would say that these are less of a threat to off-target species. However, what we're seeing now, or what some of the science is showing us, is that a lot of these chemicals are actually leaching into the ground and getting into the watershed, where they then can, you know, potentially impact aquatic species, birds, and other, you know, other species as well that are well beyond the boundary of the field.
Well, we are talking this hour about the EPA's move this month to pull 12 pesticide products from the market. These are products that are that contain a chemical that's thought to be harmful to bees. And what's your reaction to that? Is it the right move by the EPA? And how do we further protect pollinators and farmers all at the same time? Both important parts of our food production system and, of course, natural ecosystems, not just here, but around the world. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the EPA's decision to pull 12 pesticide products from the market. These products contain a chemical compound that is thought to be harmful for bees, or harmful to bees, I should say. And so that seems to be good news for pollinators. But as our guests this hour are saying, it's only the first step in what is to be a coming bigger battle over pesticides and bee health here in the United States. So we want to know what your question is. I'm joined today by Adam Allington. He's the chemicals and pesticides reporter for Bloomberg Environment and host of Bloomberg Environment's Business of Bees podcast. And he also grew up, by the way, on a cherry farm in northern Michigan. M.A. Code joins us as well. She's with us from Eugene, Oregon. She is the pesticide program director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And joining us now from Windermere, North Dakota, is Carson Klosterman. He is a corn and soybean farmer who uses neonics, that's that chemical compound, in his farming, and he's former president of the North Dakota Corn Growers Association. Carson Klosterman, welcome to On Point.
Morning, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So first of all, can you just describe to us, I mean, I said here that you use these neonics in your farming. Describe to us how you use them.
So as it's been alluded to a couple times here in the first part of the show is the neonicotinoids is seed treatment, and that's where I think you would see a lot of the, in the agriculture industry, where the use is coated either on corn plants, corn seeds, soybean seeds, and then that way when we plant it in the ground, you know, we feel that we're putting that about 2 inches in the ground. It helps us with numerous below-ground insects, which therefore helps us in positive return on investment to better feed the world and keep our costs of production low.
Is the EPA's decision to pull these 12 products, is it going to make a meaningful difference on how you farm your land?
Well, I'd like to discuss this EPA report a little bit because I'm hearing a lot of talking points at the beginning regarding, you know, endangered species, and this lawsuit was for the better being of the bees, when in reality this lawsuit, and I know one of the chemical companies sent you a letter back, and that's what I'm understanding, is that this lawsuit stems from the EPA not following the Endangered Species Act. So the activist groups, you know, went after that 2013 lawsuit and sued them. Really nothing about the health of insects or bees, but more so as a procedural issue, and that's why the companies gave up 12 minor insecticides that carry the neonic ingredient probably rather quickly. But I think, as we all know, that, yeah, the re-registration is coming up in 2022, which will probably be a little bit more of a fight. But perhaps the companies will have their acts together, or research will be done by then. But, I mean, the whole seed treatment is a very, very useful tool for the agriculture industry, and I would almost branch it out there as to, you know, big box stores sell a lot of the neonicotinoids for treating your trees if you have insects issues with your trees. The potted flowers that everybody goes and buys, you really got to scratch your head. I mean, why do those flowers look so good? And if you dive into that, you know, probably how much, you know, fertilizer, chemical, and treatment been put on there too. So it's if you go by pounds of active ingredients, the agriculture industry probably uses very little compared to, you know, consumer purchased big box stores.
So Carson, hang on here for just a second. I want to allow MA Code a chance to respond to you. So what would you say, MA, to Carson?
Well, I guess I'm sitting and listening, and I agree that seed treatments has really over the last few decades has altered modern agriculture dramatically. And it is a tool in the toolbox. And I would take a step back and say, at this point, we're using seed treatments like someone who is prone to earaches and decides to take antibiotics, and instead of waiting and seeing what we've got. And there is a time and a place for seed treatments, but unfortunately, we're buying, you know, seeds are now being marketed already treated with a whole slew of different chemicals on them. Sometimes farmers don't even know what all has been put on those seeds, and we're putting them in the ground. There's a number of concerns with that. There's issues for pollinators when you've got dust off when they're planted and dust flies into the air. There's water quality issues that Adam was talking about. And there's resistance issues. If we're continuing to use these chemicals, they might not be as effective over the long haul. So stepping back and really thinking about, again, kind of like a tool like an antibiotic, when is it the right tool and when is it not? Right now, we're just using it them prophylactically.
Carson, let me turn back to you here, because I understand that back in 2015, you actually swapped jobs for a short period of time with a commercial beekeeper named Randy Verhoek. With the Honeybee Health Coalition. And in fact, they made a video about your job swap here. So I just want to play a little bit of it. This is Randy Verhoek talking about the bad year he had with his honeybees.
The very next year, we only shipped 3,000 hives out to the almonds. And so that was pretty devastating because, you know, we lost a lot of bees that winter, and the hives that were still alive, they were really weak. you just take it so personally. It's like somebody just punches you in the gut, and you're just like, man, what did I do wrong? What could I have done different? And you just have to step back and regroup and go for it again.
That's commercial beekeeper Randy Verhoek. Carson Klosterman swapped jobs with him in 2015. So, Carson, what did you learn about bees when in doing that?
Well, I like that clip that you played because it really, really made sound, you know, it played good into the whole neonics, and he said he shipped a lot less bees. And now I'm going to say that that's because he had a bad winter. That was not related to any neonic issues. What you'll see in the bee industry is a lot of poor health, and that was alluded to earlier. Just like a human being, you know, yes, if you're healthier, you can probably combat the common cold a little bit sooner. Not saying that that's going to fix an insecticide issue or whatnot, but from what I learned on that Honeybee Health Coalition job swap is that there's a lot of issues that affect the beekeepers, and they really pointed it to health. And I still stay in contact quite a bit with Randy, and the one thing that he is working on now is when they put their hives, you know, to rest in the winter months, is they're doing it inside of a building to keep them confined, keep it a little bit more climate controlled. And he's finding that by doing that, he has much better recovery come springtime when they wake those bees up to make them start working. Mm. And those bees, if you think about it, they go through quite a bit. I mean, this isn't just a couple hives in your backyard, but he will make honey in Texas. He will make honey in North Dakota, which North Dakota is number one producing honey-producing yeah. state in the U.S. But then they also go out to California to pollinate almonds. So if you're working your assets that much, just think of how healthy you need to keep them and what issues you could pick up on the travels in those numerous states.
Okay, but Carson, let me ask you, do I have this right that after this swap, though, you set aside, 10 acres of your land for bee health, essentially, that you're not farming those 10 acres in the traditional way?
Yep, so okay. We had one quarter of ground, and it just worked out kind of nice, where we planted some rows of aronia berries, and then we interseeded in between the rows with some alfalfa, sweet clover, and such. Mm-hmm. Just and then there is a couple bee folks in the area, and I, you know, offer it up to them to put their hives out there. So yeah.
There's yeah. Well, so let me turn back to Adam Allington here with Bloomberg Environment, and he's got the Business of Bees podcast, and he's the chemical and pesticides reporter for Bloomberg Environment. Adam, Aimee made the point a little earlier that she sees that there's a toolkit for farmers to use. And the question is, how much should neonics be part of that toolkit? I mean, tell us more about what your reporting has discovered. Is there any consensus amongst farmers about the centrality of neonics in their farming?
Well, I think, you know, as Carson mentioned, you know, having a number of chemicals at your disposal is a very important part of modern farming today. I mean, we've seen this with other pesticides as well, such as Roundup, where weeds will build up a resistance to the chemical over time, and then you need to switch to a different one. And this is kind of a cycle that we see in the business of pesticides where, you know, for whatever reason, one pesticide is either found to be toxic or harmful, and so it's pulled off the market and we have a new one. And then later on, we discover that pesticide has its own set of issues as well. And so this is kind of that back and forth that we see all across agriculture where, you know, the goals of the farmer and the goals of society to have these crops available at the prices we can afford are in sync, but then, you know, the impact that we're having by putting so many of these chemicals out into the environment is causing impacts that, you know, take some serious time to unwind and for the science to catch up. So, I mean, I would say that neonics are indeed, when farmers tell you that they need those insecticides, they're not kidding. They, you know, they do the job and they do the job well. But, you know, it's a question of how much can, you know, how much are we willing to, you know, see a change in our grocery store bill or the availability of certain, you know, crops in the market if in exchange for decreased yields, perhaps, or, you know, farms that aren't producing at the level they are right now.
Right. Well, let's go to the phones. Pat is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. When I was a kid, you could run around and find bees in every lawn, flies, different types of bugs everywhere. And you really do, you also saw thousands of blackbirds in the air over the Eastern Shore and, you know, any place you went in the country. And all that has disappeared. And desire to get more out of our yields and things like that has put species at risk all over the place. And I'm wondering, is it not like we're getting more and more stressed to put, you know, to make money, et cetera, to make all those kind of things work for us? Mm. And are we passing those stresses on to the rest of the world, to the other species?
Yeah.
Because we just can't get enough.
Well, Pat, thank you for your call. MA Code, would you like to respond to him?
Well, you know, I've noticed the same thing over my life, and I'm glad you brought up all those different bees and butterflies that we normally see in the environment, because we've been talking about honeybees, and the reality is we've got so many. We have thousands of native bees here in the United States. We don't have – and they – you know, Karsten talked about how beekeepers can help keep their honeybees safer. That's not the case for our native bees. And absolutely, the fact that we now – have pest management and pesticides being synonymous is part of the problem as why we're seeing such a huge decline in our invertebrate populations, our butterflies, our bees, and so many other important foundational species. I think, and there's a lot of farmers that are out there. We're talking yield. We're talking about how much we can produce for the world. I want to take a step back and look at those innovative farmers that are out there that are using fewer and fewer chemicals that are, you know, to use a buzzword, are really moving into regenerative agriculture, where we really are looking at finding solutions to problems instead of just responding to the pests that are there because of problems. Mm-hmm. So,
well, Carson, let me turn back to Carson Klosterman on that, because Carson, we're talking about these dozen products, which is not a whole heck of a lot, but it's one move that the EPA has made, and to your point, in response to a lawsuit. But as we discussed earlier in the hour, you know, there's a lot of pesticides that are going to come up for recertification that, you know, who knows, may be eventually also taken off the market. I'm just wondering sort of what is it, what impact could this have on your farming, and are there sort of realistic alternatives that you think you could turn to?
I'd welcome that guy to my place, because I tell you what, a lot of blackbirds equal a lot of droppings on vehicles. So he might not be missing out on much there. But we would definitely be giving up something on giving up our neonic seed treatment. Uh-huh. And granted, there's other seed treatments out there probably too that maybe perhaps carry a different active mode of action. But we also get kind of thrown under the bus by, you know, the buzzword GMO, which originally was just started as biotechnology, BT corn. And that was kind of our first big deal, was just introducing a protein into the corn plant, which helped control European corn borer. European corn borer is devastating late season in the corn crop, because it'll get up into your ear of corn at the shank, and that's where the ear is connected to the stalk, and then that would essentially drop your ear, which then you wouldn't get to harvest that ear. So there's still technology being done with natural proteins in corn to fight insects. The problem with that is that you have to have feeding of your roots before that bug ingests the protein. So you're already giving yield by having feeding on your roots.
Right. Well, Carson Klosterman, a corn and soybean farmer who uses neonics, joining us from Windermere, North Dakota, also former president of the North Dakota Corn Growers Association. Carson Klosterman, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks.
Well, we are talking about the EPA's decision to pull a dozen products, a dozen pesticides from the market that contain neonics. That's a class of chemical compounds that's thought to be harmful to bees. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the EPA's decision, recent decision to pull 12 products from the market. They're pesticides that contain a compound commonly known as neonics that's thought to be harmful for bees. And I'm joined today by Adam Allington. He's chemicals and pesticides reporter for Bloomberg Environment and host of the podcast Business of Bees. Amy Code also joins us. She's the pesticide program director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And earlier in this hour, we also heard from Carson Klosterman. He's a corn and soybean farmer who uses neonics on his farm in North Dakota. And let's go back to the phones here. Owen is calling from Wayawega, Wisconsin. Owen, did I say your town name right? I'm sorry if I screwed it up.
Pretty close. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you all right. First of all, how do you say where you're from? I want to be sure I get it right.
Wayawega.
Wayawega. Okay, great. So, Owen, go ahead.
Okay. So, I'm a beginning dairy farmer, and the contradictory statements that I'm hearing from different consultants that I'm dealing with here on the farm, some consultants from the Dairy Business Association are recommending that you hire subcontractors to do all your pesticide application because it eliminates your potential risk for litigation and compensatory damage claims caused from any type of carcinogenic risk that may be associated with the use of those types of dangerous controlled substances. And also, there is information coming from Monsanto saying that these chemicals are not dangerous and there's no scientific data or research that proves any risk to human health because of these products. And they are suggesting that we can still use these products safely around children and pets without any potential risks.
Uh-huh.
So why are we being told that we need to protect ourselves by using, let's say, labor that isn't even citizens of this country because they have less ability to follow through legal parameters that could help protect them in the future? Because most of our employees here now are all Mexican nationals and Guatemalan nationals, mm-hmm. and other foreign citizens. They have no protection, and I think that the broad scheme of things here is to try to eliminate the actual American citizens who are farming from agriculture so they don't have a risk to Monsanto's overall bottom line and profits.
Well, Owen, thank you so much for your call. MA Code, do you want to respond to Owen?
I mean, that's hard. The reality is we don't necessarily have a smoking gun. It's not obvious when you're exposed to pesticides over years what that's going to do to you. And the fact that we don't have a smoking gun allows sometimes people to be able to say, yep, we're not causing harm. But what Owen is bringing up is that, yet there are still risks. All too often, we have a regulatory system that can't understand all of the risks that we might be facing and taking that step back and being recognizing these are toxic substances. We are choosing to use them in the environment. Therefore, we need to be extremely smart about that. They need to be the last resort, not the first line of defense. There are so many options out there. There are so many growers that are showing us that we can produce food for the world without heavy chemical use. And we really need to be learning from that and taking those steps, because we're not going to have a smoking gun. We're not going to necessarily have an obvious link, but we do know that there are concerns with these products out there.
Owen, though, pointing out what he sees as a gap between what companies like Monsanto say and do, though, in terms of advising him as a young dairy farmer. But let's go to Laura, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Thank you. So I belong to an organization called SILT, Sustainable Iowa Land Trust. And one of the things we work on is taking land that would otherwise be used for commodities or large-scale farming or even paved over for suburban sprawl. And we connect the land with young farmers. It's really expensive to get into the business. And the caveat, though, is that that land has to be used in a sustainable way. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding is smaller scale farmers, and when I say smaller, I mean like 500 to 1,000 acres, maybe 2,000. They're actually, when they turn to organic or even a mixture of organic and other stuff, they're getting more yield per acre. So this idea that the commodities market, you know, feeding the world and all that, or even feeding the ethanol market, is that it's quantity over quality.
Right.
And that's why chemicals play such a big part in that. And what we're finding is when we go back to using more traditional methods that we had before the 50s and all these chemicals came out, is we're getting a mix, you know, and mixing technology with that, you know, folklore training that we've been using for thousands of years, uh-huh. is that we're actually finding a nice medium and producing more per acre sometimes, but definitely more profit per acre. So I think that should be looked at because it is, you know, we're finding blue baby syndrome here in Iowa from dirty water.
Right.
Our soil and, you know, the topsoil is washing away. So we're going to be in big trouble if we don't turn around how we farm, for
right.
sure.
Well, Laura, thank you for your call. Adam Allington, let me turn back to you on that, because really interesting observation from Laura there on perhaps getting better yields from smaller farms, but that the ubiquity of the commodities market might be trapping farmers who want to, you know, try alternatives, though.
Right. You know, you can really hear that, you know, from the callers we've had, that this is an issue people feel quite strongly about. But, you know, just to bring it back to, you know, what we might expect over the next couple years for, say,
yeah.
the neonicotinoids, you know, the EU has already regulated neonics quite heavily. In fact, they've, of the five neonics on the market, they've banned three of them, and the two that remain are only allowed to be used in greenhouses for plants that spend their entire life cycle in a greenhouse. So essentially removing the use of neonics completely from outdoor use. And with, you know, with regulators, they tend to kind of eventually move in lockstep. So we could look at what's happening in the EU, and that could be a good indicator how EPA may behave in the future. You know, a lot of these regulators are looking at the same studies. So, you know, neonics are definitely on the radar of regulators, and there's a lot of science being done right now that's going to help decide whether or not we use these in the future.
So just a couple of really quick questions. We have about a minute left to go here, Adam. I should have asked you much earlier, you know, these 12 products that have been pulled from the market, I mean, is it a small portion of the overall number of products that have neonics in them in the United States?
It is. Okay. You know, a lot of these were products that were already on their way out. So, you know, these are the ones that the companies could probably live most without. And again, the real battle is going to be,
right.
you know, by July of 2022, when all of this entire active ingredient class has to be re-registered. And that's going to be the one where we decide if these stay on the market at all.
I see. And MA Code, just got 30 seconds left here to go. Your final thought on this, as Adam's saying, do you see this as the first step in perhaps a significant reassessment of these pesticides in the United States?
I'm going to go even bigger, and I think that the re-registering neonicotinoids is a small part of it, because the reality is we went from organochlorines like DDT to organophosphates to neonicotinoids. We need to actually be going to that regenerative agriculture like Laura was talking about in Iowa to be more sustainable. We need to shift our system dramatically.
Well, Aimee Code, joining us from Eugene, Oregon. She's the Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Aimee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And Adam Allington with us from Washington, the chemicals and pesticides reporter for Bloomberg Environment and host of the Business of Bees podcast. Adam, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, in a moment, we'll hear about why many national labor unions are opposing the so-called Green New Deal. This is On Point. National labor leaders are speaking out forcefully against the so-called Green New Deal. That's the proposal from Democratic Senator Ed Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that calls for transitioning the U.S. to a clean energy economy while also protecting workers. And yet, the AFL-CIO said in a letter to Markey and Ocasio-Cortez that the Green New Deal could, quote, cause immediate harm to millions of our members and their families. It's opened up a complex divide between climate activists and labor, two groups traditionally considered reliable parts of the Democratic base. So what is going on here? Joining us now with more from Washington is Umer Irfan, who reports on climate change, energy, and the environment for Vox. Umer, it's good to have you back.
Hello, Meghna.
So tell us, who amongst labor is speaking out against the Green New Deal, and what are their concerns?
Well, before we begin, I should just probably disclose up top that I'm actively involved in union negotiations with the union that's affiliated with the AFL-CIO. But to answer your question, I mean, the labor union movement is quite large. That's 12.5 million workers that are affiliated with the national AFL-CIO. But on the whole, the fossil fuels industry is much more unionized than in clean energy, and so they have a louder voice at the table. And when they see a proposal like the Green New Deal that they see as something that's going to eliminate their entire sector, they're alarmed and very skeptical that they can pull off all the provisions that are baked into it.
Okay, so we have the United Mine Workers Association, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Who else?
Well, some of the utility workers and some of the building trades organizations. The letter you referred to up top, that was signed by the AFL-CIO's Energy Committee. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to be clear that it's not a representative of the AFL-CIO as a whole. But the energy sector unions, I think the big objections that they had, or the most consistent one, was that they weren't involved in drafting this proposal. The framers of the Green New Deal said they had unions at the table, but the energy union saying that they in particular were not involved, and they feel like they were left out of the discussion and they didn't get some of the provisions that they would have liked in a proposal that would be so disruptive to their industry.
Okay, because yes, I see they're saying here that they say the very nature of the proposal itself would lead to the loss of every job associated with coal-fired powers, they say, and quick loss for jobs for anything in the natural gas sector. So, I mean, what else would they... Given that fundamental critique they have of the Green New Deal, what would they have preferred to see in it that would alleviate their concerns? Because Markey and Ocasio-Cortez would say, well, they had labor in mind from the beginning, calling for a humane transition to a clean energy economy.
Well, one big provision, I talked to a representative of the United Mine Workers, and he pointed out that they would have liked to see more technology being featured, and specifically technologies like carbon capture and sequestration. That would have extended sort of a lifeline to the coal industry and allowed them to operate in an environment where, you know, carbon dioxide is being severely restricted, and that would have, like, kept them a little bit competitive longer. The other big thing, though, that they pointed out is that this idea of a just transition sounds good in theory, but it's never happened in practice. That anytime there has been a major transition in the U.S. economy or in the global economy, workers are left by the wayside, and often there isn't enough political capital to make sure that they don't get, you know, laid off, or that they all lose their jobs or get transitioned to work that is much less fulfilling or much less compensatory.
So, Umer, we should talk about some fundamentals in terms of unionization in the clean energy sector right now. How unionized is it, and how does it compare to these other industries we're talking about?
I mean, the fossil fuel sector, typically coal, gas, and oil, are roughly around 10 to 12%, depending on what slice of the operations you're looking at. But in clean energy like wind and solar, we're looking at 3 to 4% unionization. And while wind and solar are rapidly growing, they're some of the largest sources of new jobs in this country. The industries that they're coming from, I mean, they're being supported a lot by venture capital firms and a lot of Silicon Valley tech investors. And that's a sector that's been notoriously hostile to unions. And so they don't really have a tradition of organizing. And that's kind of why that they don't have as loud of a voice at the table than the traditional fossil fuel unions, which have, you know, almost a century of history, basically, in the labor movement.
Yeah. I mean, as you've reported, the average starting salary for a coal mine worker is $60,000 as a starting salary, but that currently the average salary, say, for a solar installer is $53,000. So, you know, if this transition is made and if – big if it's made rather quickly, you're talking about a potential downgrade in income for many workers.
That's right, and so what they're looking for is some sort of insurance policy to make sure that they don't see, you know, a significant downgrade in their standard of living. So they want maybe perhaps compensation from the government to help make sure that to fill in the void of whatever that difference is in terms of salary. But another thing to point out that, like, you know, the solar industry, for example, it operates a lot with contractors, and often those folks are exempted from union organizing because they're independent contractors and they're not necessarily employed by a company. And so that makes that organizing effort more difficult, even if they do want to unionize.
Okay.
And so transitioning from a union job that has like all these protections built in, like pensions and health care and disability, to a job where you're kind of left on your own. Like, even if it was the same salary, I mean, you're losing a lot of the protections that unions had fought for decades.
It does raise the question of why, for let's just take the AFL or other national unions, don't see this as an opportunity to perhaps organize in the clean energy sector.
Well, that's a big divide in the union movement right now. I mean, yes, there is definitely a contingency that says that they should be investing a lot more resources in organizing clean tech because it is one of the fastest growing sectors in the economy. That's where the growth is going to be from here on out. The fossil fuel sector is already losing ground just on economics. And at the state level, you are seeing union organizations making that argument and coming on board with some of these more aggressive proposals.
Mm. Well, how have Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez responded to this pretty significant pushback from the national level of labor leaders?
Well, I haven't seen anything too overt in terms of pushback, but from talking to labor groups, they have opened some more back channels with some of the advocates for the Green New Deal. They are having those conversations now. But I think the key thing to pay attention to now is the state level proposals. Like, in addition to the federal Green New Deal proposed in Congress, I mean, a lot of states have their own ambitious plans to transition away from fossil fuels towards clean energy. And there you're seeing actually a lot more support for those proposals because unions were involved in the beginning. And I would point to the example of Maine, where the Maine AFL-CIO openly endorsed their version of the Green New Deal.
Mm. Well, Umer Irfan covers climate change, energy, and the environment for Vox. Umer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, by the way, before we wrap up today, a note about an upcoming special broadcast. My colleague David Folkenflik will be in New Orleans on Thursday, taping the show from the National World War II Museum in front of a live audience. We're commemorating the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and you can find a link if you want tickets to this. The link is at our website, onpointradio.org. And we also want your memories or questions as we seek to honor veteran stories. You can submit your World War II comments or anecdotes or family stories at onpointradio.org, or you can call in and leave us a voicemail. That number is 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.